It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We have a new food word, miroir, the ocean version of terroir, meaning the taste of place. Now, I don't think the French have heard about miroir yet, but in this show, it links two stories of changed lives. In one, a couple loses their fishing business, but finds there's more than fish in the sea to live on. And in the second story, a woman chooses to trade in her heels and great job for mud boots and an oyster farm. She wanted to know the real world of food and to know miroir firsthand. Well, stick around for your calls and more reality checks this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we ask the question, why would a woman with a cushy job reporting on the good life in Boston quit so that she can stand ankle deep in freezing water in lousy weather nursing a bunch of oysters? Well, this is how the book Shucked, Life on a New England Oyster Farm opens. Its author, Erin Byers Murray, joins us. Erin, welcome.
It's good to be here, Lynn.
So, okay, how did you come to this?
Well, I was, like you said, living this great life in Boston. I had a good career. I was making good money. I was satisfied professionally. But there was something that I wasn't being fulfilled by. And I was writing about food, and I understood where food came from, but I really hadn't seen how food was produced. I hadn't ever gotten my hands dirty. And at the same time, this was that I was in search of something. I happened to meet a group of oyster farmers from Island Creek Oysters, and they asked me if I wanted to take a tour of the farm for story ideas. So I went down on this gorgeous 80-degree day in August and got in the water in my waders and looked around and thought, wow, this is pretty spectacular. I could see myself doing this. And the farmers said, you know, well, we're out here in January doing it. And we're chainsawing through the ice to do it. And I thought, now that is what I want to do. So I concocted a plan and I quit my job and went to work for the farm at Island Creek.
What was this like for you when you actually got into it?
It was tough. It was backbreaking. I was bent over for hours at a time. I was standing in the freezing cold for, you know, 12 hours straight. And I, believe it or not, I actually liked it. This sounds terrible, but I did love it. But the first couple of months were brutal. My body had to be broken down and then rebuild itself based on the work that I was doing.
Could you explain to us how you farm an oyster?
Sure. So oysters come to the farm from a hatchery. They're spawned in a controlled environment, and we call them seed, but they're actually baby oysters. They're actually fully formed oysters that are about the size of a pepper flake. So when the farmer gets them, her job is to get them up to a size where they're safe to live in the water. So we keep them in controlled tanks and we pump them with, you know, the bay water, and they are grown from the pepper flake size up to about a quarter of an inch in probably 3 or 4 months. And from that process, we then put them into a nursery where they're grown out a little bigger in a more protected environment. And then Island Creek finishes their oysters for the last 8 to 12 months, actually growing on the bottom of the bay floor right in Duxbury Harbor.
So what was the first task you had to do when you went there?
I started out culling, and culling is the process of sorting the oysters. Oysters grow at different speeds, so you know, we would harvest the oysters, and that was something we usually did by hand. We would go out and hand pick the oysters off the bay floor during a low tide, and then we'd bring them back to, we had a floating processing plex, we called it. It's a barge, and we would work on that barge and basically take all the oysters we'd harvested and drop them out onto a table. So imagine a pile of oysters the size of, say, a turkey. And basically, one by one, you're sorting through to separate them by size and by shape. And in the process, you're handling each and every oyster. But you're also standing across the table from your crewmates for up to 8 to 10 hours at a time, no matter what the conditions are. So that was the part that was a little daunting to me at first, because you just see piles of oysters in your dreams, or they're washing past you at all times. But the process of culling, it helps you understand, you know, why oysters are such a unique product, because each one is completely different, and they grow in a very unique way.
So what are you looking for when you cull?
So Island Creeks have this really consistent, round, almost teardrop shape, and they have a deep cup, which, you know, you measure probably about maybe an inch or two between your fingers, and they are usually about 3 inches in length, sometimes a little bit longer. So any ones that are not that are maybe smaller or mm-hmm. misshapen, they might go out back out into the water where they would regrow or do a little bit more maturing before we harvested them again.
The level of handwork that you talked about in the book was so striking. And then you said something about they sell these for 75 cents each. And you have to question, how do people make any real money doing this work?
Good question. Now, it is a lot of hands-on work. And the oysters are handled anywhere from 15 to 20 times in their life cycle.
Whoa,
and for something that grows in the water, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But we really, as farmers, we were crafting their growth. We were pruning their shape a little and chipping off the edge of their shell so that they could regrow stronger. And all of that is what creates that consistent shape. So that handiwork does require a lot of time and attention and energy. The way I think farmers make up for that is volume. The yield of an oyster crop, if let's say you're getting 1 million oyster seed, you might only see 300,000 to 400,000 of those come up as edible, sellable oysters. So, you know, they might only do the work themselves as opposed to hiring a crew of people to do it. So it's quite an investment. It might take 3 years for an oyster farmer to see any kind of profit.
So after all of this, did you actually find what you were looking for?
Yes, I did. I found passion in my work. I didn't start this project to become an oyster farmer. There are people out there that are going to always do that better than I ever could. But turns out I actually really like being a writer. So for me, it was about regrouping and stepping back and understanding why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Well, Erin, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn.
Erin Byers-Murray is author of Shucked, Life on a New England Oyster Farm. Now, when you talk about oysters, I think oyster stew, pure luxury and elementally simple. And if you do it right, the oysters just shine through. Now, you always start oyster stew the same way. You get a pint of shucked oysters, you check them over for shells, you pull them out of their liquid, strain the liquid, and do not let a single drop get wasted. Then you do a creamy broth. You start with sautéed shallots, a little garlic. You add half milk and half cream. You bring it to just below the simmer. Stir in the oysters in their liquid, maybe 2 drops of Tabasco, and you heat that just long enough for the oysters to curl, maybe a minute. And then you spoon that up with oyster crackers. Now you can find my recipe for creamy oyster stew on the website, splendidtable.org. When Erin Byers-Murray was talking about that Massachusetts oyster farm, she used a new food word, miroir. That's the ocean spinoff of terroir, meaning the taste of a specific place. Well, not too long ago, California reporter Lisa Morehouse discovered miroir at work, saving a couple's livelihood on the Pacific coast.
Bob Lamar is a farmer, but his tractor is a boat.
We've got a little window this morning to harvest, and then that'll be it.
He's heading to his favorite harvesting spot before the waters off the Mendocino coast get too rough.
Okay, this looks about right.
He turns off the engine about 3 miles from the Point Arena Pier.
Isn't that beautiful? Just being out here and it's nice and quiet. We're over a canyon called Arena Canyon.
Lamar farms salt and he harvests ocean water. But not just any water. He says the currents here push mineral-rich, highly saline water from the canyon up to the surface, which gives this salt a unique flavor.
I call it Merlot. Like terroir is for wine. You know, wine will take on the flavors and the characteristics of where the grapes are grown. We believe that salt has a Merlot or an ocean flavor.
He throws an intake hose into the water, another line into a 200-gallon tank on the boat, and starts a pump to harvest the seawater. On a typical day, he'll make 9 trips out in his boat, delivering a total of 1,800 gallons of water to holding tanks at his house in Wallala on the southern Mendocino coast. Lamar sounds upbeat now, but 3 years ago, he and his wife Laura were depressed. They'd closed their sport fishing business right when the recession started and didn't know what was next. For a break, they decided to take a trip to San Francisco and found themselves in a gourmet food store.
I was looking at a wall of salts.
A dozen, at the least, sea salts from all around the world.
Wait a minute. Where's the North Coast salt?
And we both stood there like children in front of a window at a candy store at Christmas time.
And it was like, oh my gosh. We're going to make our own salt.
It was instantaneous.
I'll never forget that moment. So we went home, put our rubber boots on, and
we went down to Schooner Gulch Beach and got a 5-gallon bucket of salt water, and that's how it started.
But that first batch tasted terrible and looked like popcorn. And that started Laura and Bob on a research and testing mission. Laura ordered salts from around the world. Bob consulted scientists. They scoured websites for clues, and they made batches and batches of salt.
We were truly like mad scientists in there. We had like salt everywhere, and it was in the drawers. Yes. It was in the dogs, you know. I'd find salt everywhere.
It took Bob months to make a batch that met with Laura's high standards. She'd been a caterer and had experimented with seasoning blends for decades. They launched Lamar's Mendocino Sea Salt and Seasoning Company. Bob collected temperature and humidity data meticulously to arrive at a formula that works every time. He guards the exact numbers carefully. In what he calls the salt shed, Bob boils seawater down to create a concentrated brine.
It just gets gin clear. Yikes, that's salty.
Then it bakes in a special oven for over 20 hours. Salt crystals form on the surface and fall to the bottom of the baking pan.
Once I get the salt pan driving, it's like snow. So they're all spinning and falling like snowflakes.
He lets the salt drain for a few days, siphoning off extra liquid. Bob and Laura Lamar sell their regular and smoked salts and seasoning blends at markets and food festivals from Mendocino to Marin. They frequently make the 5-hour trek from their home in Wallala to the Marin Civic Center Farmers Market.
Well, we're kind of proud of it because it produces a salt.
Heather Manning's here because she tried a pinch of the salt at a friend's house.
I'm so excited to finally get to see you.
Oh, good.
Get my own salt.
I'm glad we're here for you.
We actually did a saute with kale, and then we added a little bit of your sea salt at the very end. It was so good.
It's conversations like this that get the Lamars most of their business, from neighborhood retail outlets to some of California's most lauded restaurants, like Cyrus in Healdsburg. Back at home, Laura, who says she's an eternal optimist, keeps a memento on her desk just in case she gets discouraged. A jar of that first terrible salt that looks like popcorn.
I'll look at it sometimes for inspiration and go, okay, that's where we started. Here's where we are. And I know we need to be there. We will be in time.
And the numbers seem to bear this out. The Lamars say business is doubling every year.
Lisa Morehouse is a reporter with KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Now we're going to be back with what could be America's next style switch in wine drinking. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl is a wine and food writer. She's editor-in-chief of Real Food Magazine, among her other credits. Well, Dara claims we Americans are switching our style of wine drinking big time. She's written Drink This, Wine Made Simple, and she's here in the studio with me with a clutch of bottles. Dara, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now, you say you're seeing a big trend happening in the wine aisles. What do you see happening?
Low alcohol wines are coming back. You know, for the last 20 years, it's been higher and higher alcohol percentages. Cabernet Sauvignon's going to 16, 17%. Zinfandel's right alongside. I mean, wine, table wines with alcoholic strength of port. And there's sort of a theory about where they all come from, and they all come from one man's taste. Robert Parker Jr., the most famous wine critic in the world, he is sort of wonderful. You know, he's so clarifying. His palate is so good. And yet he loves what a lot of people call fruit bombs. And fruit bombs are just, you know, so jammy, so big, so plush. And to get that kind of sweetness in the fruit, you have to, you know, leave it on the vines for the longest time. It gets sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. And then you have a ton of sugar. The way wine works, you know, you use special yeast that turns the sugar in the grapes into alcohol. The sweeter the grapes, the more alcoholic the wine.
And the more alcoholic the wine,
the better it shows in one of these tastings where you're sitting there with 100 bottles of wine in front of you. And so people feel like these wines that get the Parker points, you know, they get 96 points, 100 points. Mm-hmm. You see them on all the wine aisles, these little shelf talkers, little flags that wave at you with their beguiling numbers. And these wines show so well in a giant tasting, they do not show so well at your table. I mean, you put one of these Cabernet Sauvignons next to, a roast lamb dish, and it's just like putting Godzilla at the table with Bambi, you know, just smash, crash, bam. You don't get to taste what you're eating. It's too much alcohol.
Okay, so you brought us some low alcohol options. Tell us about them.
Low alcohol wines are typically old world, old fashioned wines. So wines in which the alcohol has been stopped for one reason or another. Either there's leaving some sweetness in there in wines like the Moscato d'Asti, or the wines are growing in cold places like Germany or Champagne, places where they're not going to get tons of sugar in the grape. And those are very balanced, elegant, quieter wines. And the first thing I brought is a Moscato, because this is the wine that's sort of taking America by storm. And it is really, the consumption of it is driven by women. Ladies love Moscato. They have discovered it. It's so floral. It just is a flower garden in a glass. It leaps out. It's pretty. It's roses. It's honeysuckle. It's just a flower garden of just prettiness and low alcohol. And it goes great with fruit. It goes great with cheese. How many times you want to just have people over on the deck and have the fruit and cheese and wine? Mm-hmm. This is the wine.
Okay, so I've got some in the glass. We're going to take a quick taste?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, that is nice. You know what this is going to be great with? This is going to be great with a pad thai.
It's very good with all those kind of spicy foods, but it's also great at brunch. And it's just a nice cocktail wine. They're inexpensive. You can find good Moscatos, you know, $8 and up.
Mm-hmm. So what else have you brought in, Dara?
I brought a Riesling because I don't think you can really talk low alcohol without talking Riesling. Now, why is there low alcohol in traditional German and Austrian Rieslings? Because it doesn't get very hot there, so they don't get very sweet. Therefore, there's nothing to really turn into, you know, pounds and pounds of alcohol in your wine. Mm-hmm. You know, Rieslings are known for their nerve. What does that mean? It's that sort of energy that kind of ricochets through it. And that delicacy, that nerve, that energy, that comes from careful winemaking and just a really light hand. And too much alcohol would absolutely destroy a Riesling.
So which Riesling is this?
It's the Heinz Eifel. It's a Mosel Riesling, and it's just beautiful.
All right. Now, this is a very flowery, fruity Riesling, but Riesling comes dry. It
sure
comes sweet. It has so many different faces, and you can drink Riesling with almost anything.
Yeah. You know, and the other thing to know about wine alcohol percentages is the number that you see on the bottle is not necessarily exact. Tax law in the U.S. goes sort of breaks at 14%. So anytime you see 14%, that could be 15, it could be 14.2. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just basically erring on the side of the tax law. And it breaks the other way as well. If you see 13.5, it might be 12. The 8% alcohol might be 8.5. It's an agricultural product.
Right.
Every grapevine might be slightly different.
What about low alcohol reds? Because so far we've been talking whites.
Yes, there are actually a number of red wines and even domestic red wines. Some people think you can't have American red wines with a decent alcohol level because they are, you know, it's too sunny. It's just too sunny in California. Mm-hmm. But there's actually a group of people that have signed a pledge that's in pursuit of balance. And wineries like Calera, which is a Pinot Noir specialist, Aubin Clamat, a couple places like that, they are vowing to harvest their grapes before they're raisiny, to not get those giant Parker flavors, and to not overwhelm with alcohol, just as they've been doing in Italy forever. I brought in a Langhe Italian wine, Già. It's a beautiful table wine. It's a blend of all kinds of things that just grow in Italy. Nebbiolo, Barbera, Dolcetto, places that grow in the Piedmont Hills. Mm-hmm. They typically grow side by side. And this is made at a low alcohol, only 11% for red wine. That's really fantastic.
Well, let's see what this is like.
Yeah.
This is made in the Piedmont, which is northwestern Italy. Okay. Ooh. It has a light but kind of lovely garnet color. Oh, it's dry, fresh, light-bodied, but this would be fabulous with red meats.
Or grilled meats. Or
grilled
just
meats, yeah.
An antipasto
not
platter.
Not sweet, but really delicious.
It's a balanced wine, it's a delicate wine, and it's just an enjoyable life-at-your-table wine.
Dara, this is a really refreshing change. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl's book is Drink This, Wine Made Simple. Now, those low-alcohol wines we tasted are on the website, splendidtable.org. And I should mention one of my favorite sources for dry, low-alcohol wines is Portugal, the Vino Verdes. Well, while you're on the site, download our How to Eat Weekends podcast, take a look at our blogs, and get registered for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's Allegra McEvedy's Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen, Recipes and Knives from a Traveling Chef. Register on the website, splendidtable.org. It is time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how we play. A listener calls in with five things from their refrigerator, and I have to come up with a dish made with those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. But the final judgment comes from our celebrity guest Stump Master, and this week it is the fabulous host of Top Chef, Padma Lakshmi. Padma, welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you, Lynn?
I am good. I have to say, you are the first guest celebrity stuntmaster who is actually a professional judge, and that is a tad unnerving. Now, I understand that the finale is going to be coming up soon for this season of Top Chef, right?
Yes, it's coming up on February 28th. We're very excited for everyone to watch because, you know, it's hard to keep a lid on things, and we just got back from filming it.
So you can't give us any hints, right?
No, I can't. I'm sworn to secrecy.
Okay, but this is what I want to know. Among all of you judges, are there any bets that start going on as to who you guys all think are going to be the finalists?
I mean, we talk about it, but, you know, it's not anything serious because even the best chef can have a bad day. And, you know, like baseball, you're only as good as your last game. So, you know, there have been seasons where the favorite or front runner has knocked themselves out because they just choke or they just had a cooking malfunction, as we like to endearingly say. I mean, I cannot stress enough how high the intensity is on the show. It's much harder than it looks on TV. I mean, I have such empathy and real admiration for these chefs because it's hard to hang in there, you know, with your nerves and you're away from your family and you're so tired and you don't know what's coming at you and you can't read a newspaper or check your email or, you know, it's a very grueling process and it's all done with millions of people watching your every move.
Yeah, very tricky. Well, I want you to meet our contestant. We have Steve from Omaha, Nebraska. Steve, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Padma.
Are you a fan of Top Chef?
Of course.
Yeah, I know. Hard question, right? Okay. All right, Steve. Five things in your fridge. And by the way, I do get water, salt, and pepper, and three things that you really have in your house. Okay? All right. Fire away.
Here we go. Fuji apples.
Fuji apples. Okay. Go ahead.
Raspberry chipotle barbecue sauce.
Yum.
Raspberry chipotle smoky tart sweet. Okay, go ahead.
All right, here comes my protein. It's a pepper-encrusted dry salami.
Ooh, okay, go ahead.
And then maybe speaking to your Italian roots, panettone bread.
Gee, thank you, Steve. And number five, your big finish.
It's my zinger, Kraft Singles.
Kraft Singles.
Could have been worse.
Yeah, right. You've been doing too many quick fires.
It's true. I'm not a good judge of this because everything seems doable to me.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right. So I'm looking at this. We got the Kraft Singles. We got the panettone. Now, the panettone is shot with bits of candied fruit. It's not terribly sweet. Wait a minute. Hold it a second. We've got the makings here of something kind of interesting. If we did egg cream and we did a custard base, we did browned onion.
Okay, that's three, Lynn.
I'm only speculating, Padma. I'm only speculating here. All right. Yeah, because I need fat. I need Wait a minute. Hold it a second. I'm going to scrape off some of the pepper on the salami. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cut the salami into a quarter inch dice. I'm going to cook the salami slowly in a skillet to render some of that fat and make crisp nubbins of that. Okay, salami goes out of the pan. I now have a crunchy base here. I'm going to take that. I'm going to dice up onion. I'm going to cook the onion in that.
Mm-hmm.
Take the cream and egg, and we're going to make a custard. Toast slices of the panettone under the broiler. All right. Lay that in the bottom of a shallow skillet. We're going to pour the custard over that just enough to moisten that bread. Then just break up a few of the Kraft Singles and put that over that. Not a lot. Maybe two of them. We do not want a lot of the singles.
Fair enough.
Dice up the Fuji apple and a few tablespoons of the barbecue sauce. That goes on top of the custard. That gets baked in the oven until it's just about firm. Out that comes, and then we top it with this browned onion, crunchy bits of the salami, and the fresh apple. So you get this nice contrast of the sweet, the spice of that salami, and the bits of the onion. And that is served in small squares on the plate. And if you wanted to do it, you could do just a little streak of that barbecue sauce on the plate at the same time.
Mm. I like it.
Does it pass? Does it pass?
It does. It does. I like it. I always like salty and sweet mixed together. So if you have a hint of the sweet from the apple and the panettone, you know, the spicy fat from the salami with the crunch, and I even love that the smokiness in the salami is going to be echoed in the barbecue sauce. So, you know, it's brilliant. It's literary almost, I think.
Padma, would you like to be a regular on the show? Steve, what do you think?
I think I'm inviting Padma over. We're going to devour it.
Guys, you are both dreams. Thank you both for playing. Padma,
my
thank
pleasure,
you so much.
Steve. I'll have to look you up next time I'm in your neck of the woods.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. To play Stump the Cook, call or email us with your five ingredients, and one of our clever producers may call you to play on the air. Jane and Michael Stern may have paid the mortgage of the Pepto-Bismol factory for years. It comes with the territory. It's kind of like kissing frogs to find a prince. You have to eat a lot of bad food to find good food. But their gems go on their roadfood.com site, and they get shared here, firsthand. Jane, Michael, welcome back, you guys.
Hi, Lynn.
So what's the latest?
Well, we've been in Iowa yet again. Is it my imagination, or are we always in Iowa?
I wish I was always in Iowa, at least at breakfast time when they have those great cinnamon rolls. But
anyway, we were on the Tenderloin Trail, which is one of our favorite routes, and we were in a town called Ex-Ira, Iowa, which is south of Audubon, to give you directions. And we found a wonderful place for pork and for pies. Not pork pies, but Iowa pork tenderloins and sour cream raisin pies.
But before we talk about this great food, which really is just traditional, wonderful breadbasket heartland food, we have to talk about location. You know, in real estate, it's location, location, location. The Red Barn of Ex-Ira is located in the shadow of five gigantic feed silos in the middle of nowhere. And that, to me, is the location that I want to find great farm cooking.
That's road food, location, location, location.
But anyway, the tenderloin there is fabulous. It's, you know, that pounded thin cutlet of pork with a crisp, crisp breading on a bun with farm fresh tomatoes during tomato season, onions, a little mustard. And on the side, we got something that we have found only in Iowa, which is the Iowa pea salad, which is peas, cheddar cheese, and Miracle Whip, a wonderful combination to go with a tenderloin sandwich.
Well, let me just tell you one thing that really stood out for me at the Red Barn. The pork tenderloin, which is like a wiener schnitzel on a bun, becomes like a very competitive food in Iowa. Probably at one point, the pork tenderloin was served like a hamburger, that it was the same dimension as the bun. But over the years, it has grown to like the size of a dinner plate that's served on a tiny little bun. And at the Red Barn, it was pure Iowa pride in that the tenderloin.
No, see, it wasn't the hugest.
It was about 4 inches outside the bun.
It's not really the widest in Iowa. It might be the juiciest and the most delicious, but there are some that are just insanely wide.
That look like flying saucers, right, from the 1950s. But this was a good substantial hunk of fried pork tenderloin. It was wonderful.
And then dessert. Of course, you know, Iowans are just so good with dessert, whether it be pie or what was the special of the day when we went there was rhubarb crisp, which was kind of like a sort of a, well,
I've never heard you two speechless.
I know, and I've never heard Michael speechless, which is why I'm not saying anything. I'm staring at him.
No, well, the rhubarb crisp was so good because it was really tart. I mean, what struck me about it was, you know, normally, if anything, most pies can be way sweet.
It was sort of cobbler-esque, but I know why Michael is speechless, and I'm sorry I didn't jump in that we had this dead air as he looked like a guppy, you know, trying to get his last breath. The reason I know you loved it so much is because the guy from the restaurant grew the rhubarb in his backyard.
Well, that's true. Of course it was. Of course it was local rhubarb.
I mean, who could resist?
And I think we have to mention also the place itself. It's tiny. I mean, the number of tables in the Red Barn is 4. Each has 4 chairs. So it's not at all uncommon for people who come in twos to share a table with another deuce, as we did. And it's also definitely etiquette in this place that when you're done with your meal, you get up and leave so that other people can take their seat at lunchtime.
I've never heard you say the word deuce for a table for two, Michael. How professional of you.
That's really good luncheonette talk. I like that. Guys, this sounds great. Thank you.
It is.
Okay, bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now find information on their picks at splendidtable.org. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is ready to go, and the question is, what can happen to an oyster when its shell is cracked? Well, we'll be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. Check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send an email, or Actually, call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what can an oyster do to save itself once its shell is cracked? Now, reading the book Shucked started me down this path. Well, the answer is, if the oyster is left in the water undisturbed, it can heal itself within a day. If not, it will die. An oyster shell, it might look like a rock, but it is mainly layer upon layer of calcium carbonate. And there are cells trapped between those layers. And it's thought that those cells help in the healing. And that's pretty amazing.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Clifford's on the line from Rancho Santa Fe in California. Clifford, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
How are you, Lynn?
I am good.
So we live near San Diego in a house where the former owners planted a small orchard with about 3 dozen fruit trees.
You poor soul.
Oh, well, eight or so are deciduous. So we've got a couple plums, an apricot, a white peach, persimmon. But over 2 dozen of the trees are citrus. And of those, most of them are oranges.
Right.
So, yes, we've got Meyer lemon and Eureka, a couple of limes, et cetera. But we've got just a lot of oranges, and there are only 2 of us.
Okay. Well, first of all, you could take a whole bunch of them and juice them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something that's really simple to do that you can either keep in the fridge for about a month, or you can do a whole pile of it and you can keep it in the freezer. And I call it OJ reduction. You boil down orange juice and you get this sour, sweet, wonderfully sticky sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And it can go either way. It can go over vegetables, it can go into a pan sauce. I mean, it can enliven anything. I mean, it can be a marinade, or it can go over sweets.
Yeah, yeah.
It can go, into a soup.
Uh-huh.
You know, for instance, when you're making some quick soup and it really tastes blah,
uh-huh.
You won't taste orange so much as a quarter of a cup of this is just going to give it some real punch.
Okay.
It's really great. So, and a quart of orange juice is going to give you maybe a quarter of a cup, a half a cup.
Okay.
So this is one thing you can do, and I would do it kind of pulp and all, or you could strain the pulp if you want to. That's one thing you can do. The other thing that's interesting to do, of course, is you can do candied orange peel. That's kind of a given right there. But there's something – now, I've not done this, but I think it would be really interesting to try – is take the oranges and cut them into half moons, rind and all, and then immerse them in sugar and let them sit in that sugar overnight, okay? And then drop them into a pan of boiling water. It's similar to the way you might do candied rind.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd boil it for a few moments, you'd pull it out, you'd immerse it in the sugar again.
Mm.
And there's no reason why flavorings cannot be in that sugar.
Oh.
Cinnamon sticks, crushed whole allspice, or it could get kind of sexy. It could be Aleppo chili.
Wow.
And I think what I would look up is preserving orange slices, candying orange slices. But I'm just thinking about sugar preserving, because I have done this when I've done preserves, where I've packed the fruit first in sugar for a day or so, and then taken that syrup and boiled that down and then pack the fruit in that. But when you have the rind of the orange, it's kind of bitter, and that's why I'm suggesting that you boil.
Got it.
You boil it once or twice, but you keep it in that sugar until it's absorbed a great deal of it. You might even just pack it in sugar and see what happens. Keep it in that sugar as a preservative.
Excellent.
And of course, the other thing is, if you have vodka and you have attractive jugs, or you have rum, oh, rum and orange has got to be just fabulous.
Well, you know, we concoct our own limoncello with lemons.
So we have orange cello, but I would do them with rum. Do them with clear rum. This time I would do pie-shaped pieces of the orange. You could do it with or without the rind. The rind's going to give it a bitter edge, which is not a bad thing. And you could throw spices in if you wanted, you know, for something a little unusual. But wouldn't that be a beauteous thing?
We're going to have to try that
in jugs
right
of
away.
Rum. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to get you, you know, rolling. And by the way, don't forget orange ice cream. There's a fabulous book. It's up on the website, Jenny Splendid Ice Creams.
I'll try that,
Use her base formula and throw some oranges in it. You'll see how she works. This is the best ice cream formula I've seen anywhere.
Fabulous.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye. Rule is on the line from Holland. Rule, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Are you from Holland or are you someone who's moved to Holland?
Yes, ma'am. I was born and raised in Holland, but I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan for a couple of years. So,
where are you in Holland?
I'm in Utrecht. I don't know if you're familiar with the country at all.
Oh, yes, I am. I lived in Belgium for a while, so I'm familiar.
Oh, well, then you know. Yeah, yes, somewhere in the middle in Holland. Yeah.
Right, right. So what's on your mind?
Well, my fiancé and I are getting married on June 1st this year.
Uh-huh.
And I invited a couple of my American friends, and it looks like some of them are coming, which is great. And I want to ask them to bring some typical American stuff with them for me that I can't actually get here. So
right.
I was thinking about some sauces or spice blends, but
right.
I can't get much further than a good barbecue sauce, really. So I was wondering if you have any suggestions.
Well, what are the things that you really loved when you were here? You were in Ann Arbor?
Yeah, I was. Well, there was a huge variety of good food there, as you know.
It's just
so many good restaurants. And I personally love spicy food. My fiancé is not a big fan, but I love a good, you know, barbecue, Mongolian barbecue. I love Asian food, especially.
If they could get them through customs, what about a collection of chilies? I would imagine in Holland you can get chilies, but can you get Mexican chilies?
No, you can't. I mean, there's a couple of specialized grocery stores that you can get it at, but I haven't found any near here.
Okay, then I think that's one thing you might want to ask them to bring. You know, guajillos, anchos. You can obviously look up a whole selection of dry chilies, and they'll be able to get them very easily in Ann Arbor because
right.
it's such a great international community. So that's
right.
one thing. Maybe some great salsas because
Ooh.
People have gone nuts in the United States with salsas. There's fruit salsas and there's vegetable salsas.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. Yeah, I love making enchiladas and things like that, but it's really hard to get the ingredients.
You know what else?
Salsas are great. Yeah.
This is going to weigh down their luggage beautifully, but how about the masa flour? You know, the
Ooh.
Specially treated cornmeal, the cornmeal that's treated with lime, and you never find that in Europe. You find cornmeal, but you never find the proper cornmeal, you know, that came out of Central and South America that's treated with lime. And that's something else that they can bring in a big sack, a 5-pound sack. Well, this is really wishing something on them, isn't it? But you can put that in the freezer, and that's going to keep for a year for you.
Oh, that sounds great, yeah, because it has to keep for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, maple syrup. I'm not sure if you're crazy about it. Wild rice is something else that, you know, you might want. And one, maple syrup is something I always brought to friends in Europe because they generally didn't see it. Let me think. You know the thing I missed most? And I didn't know I missed it until a friend was coming from the United States for Christmas, and she said, what would you like me to bring? And the first thing out of my mouth was sweet pickles.
Oh, really?
Well, the sweet pickles in Europe aren't like the sweet pickles in the United States, but that may not be your thing. It was my thing, and she arrived, I found out, with 15 kinds of sweet pickles, and we went crazy.
Really?
She was obsessive. She was obsessive.
Wow.
But the point being, I think that's a good list for you, and the chilies are as light as air.
I really like the idea of the chilies and the salsa. Yeah, that's really,
yeah,
really good.
Yeah, and the masa is going to get you a long way. And the other thing they could bring you are a whole variety of tortillas in white corn and yellow corn and flour tortillas. And those you put in the freezer and you will have them, you know, for quite a while. And that's the kind of stuff that's really hard to get there.
Excellent. And I can impress my new wife with them.
She will be so impressed. And then you're going to turn her into a chili head. And, you know, the two of you are going to have to regularly visit the United States and head to the Southwest.
Excellent. I can only hope so.
Hey, may it be a wonderful, wonderful ceremony and party. And may it all be glorious for the two of you.
Thanks so much, Lynn. Thanks for your suggestions.
You are welcome. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Ru. You can reach us 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. A candidate running for the White House sneezes and CNN brings in a handkerchief analyst. Yeah, the race has gotten to this extreme. But one area has been blithely unanalyzed until now, food. Every politician uses food to stump. Well, now we have our own political food analyst who is ready to dig in. Frederick Douglass Opie is professor of history and foodways at Babson College. Fred, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
So candidates use food as a way of meeting up with potential voters, but there's a lot more going on here than just eating, right?
Certainly. Food is so much about identifying with people. And when you're a candidate, particularly in a national race like we have right now, the 2012 race at the White House, as an outsider, you're going into a community and you want to identify with these potential voters, and you want them to feel as quickly as possible, I'm one of you. And so one way to do that is to mingle and meet and greet potential voters around food.
But is there anybody there coaching them about what they're eating?
Well, what happens in most campaigns is, you know, if you have enough money, you have a campaign staff set up. There's a portion of that campaign staff who are full-time people, professionals. But the largest majority of the campaign staff at the local level are volunteers. And these volunteers many times are district leaders, and they know their districts and they know their areas. So those are the people who the staffers go to and say, where should we go do a retail politics event? Where should we meet and greet voters? And that person will say, look, this is a great restaurant. This is a great place for breakfast. This is a great coffee house. This place has great barbecue. So that's usually how it's set up. You have staff depending on the expertise of volunteers on the local level.
But I guess what I'm wondering is, there are so many chances when you're dealing with different cultural groups, there are so many chances to unconsciously insult people if you don't understand what you're eating.
No, absolutely. And it's up to that activist at the local level. You're depending on the staff that this person not only knows the place to eat, but how to eat what's there or how to drink what's there. I think a good example is the primary in Florida, as you had candidates going down to South Florida trying to woo the Cuban-American vote. Now, it's one thing for you to go to a coffee event, which is one of those ones that shows up when I look at the itinerary where candidates are going. But there's coffee, and then there's Cuban coffee. And if you don't understand that you're about to take a shot of essentially Red Bull that looks like coffee, you could be in big trouble.
Did you see any goofs?
I saw a goof in the primary in South Carolina right before Rick Perry dropped out. And he went down there, and he dropped out after a number of gaffes that he made, in different arenas, certainly when you're talking about the debates. But there was an instance where he was at an event, a barbecue event, and he made the mistake of talking about how good Texas barbecue is. Now, you don't go down to South Carolina and brag about Texas barbecue and expect people to start voting for you.
Historically, has there ever been an instance where food has really influenced an election?
Oh, absolutely. The thing to keep in mind is we here in North America are the products of British culture. So this whole idea of food and politics goes all the way back to Europe and to the UK, where people use food to buy votes and to buy the influence of potential voters. So this is nothing new. It's got an old history where you would see a candidate, essentially march people, to the polls, vote, and as soon as they voted, turn the corner, and right around the corner, they have a tavern set up where you could get your drink, and talking about an alcoholic drink, that is, and get your belly full. So this has a long history that we're talking about now.
Fred, thanks for the insights.
Thank you, Lynn.
Frederick Douglass Opie is professor of history and foodways at Babson College, and for more information on stumping and eating, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in, and until next week, Let me leave you with this from President Dwight David Eisenhower, who said, "Some people wanted champagne and caviar when they should have had beer and hot dogs." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Browse our recipes, our online store, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter and special podcasts, and take a look at our latest book, How to Eat Weekends. There's a lot going on, so check it all out at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Holacek. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.